I'm an alcoholic, and my name is Rich Deeds. We're on tape here. Rich Deeds. Wow. I want to thank Billy for asking me. It's an honor and a privilege to be here. A lot of things kind of been going through my mind here lately, so, and I'll try to keep it. I heard one speaker say, she had three parts of her life, one before alcohol, one with alcohol, and one in sobriety. And my sobriety date is September 15th, 1974, which was 36 years, just celebrated last month, of continuous sobriety. I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing. By that I mean I have a home group. I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor. I'm active in the program. I sponsor people. I don't take a drink one day at a time. That's the most important thing. And that is key. That is the most important thing. So I believe I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing. I try to give back what I have been so freely given. I also am in many ways a dinosaur, not just because I'm 65 years old. You don't have to guess how old I am. I was born in February 16th, 1945, so I'm 65 years old. But I'm one of these rare leftovers who've never even tried smoking marijuana or an illegal drug. It's just the way it worked out. It was just starting to come into my high school. My older brother did, my younger brother did, and I just went off in a different direction when I went in the Army. More about that later. So I'm a pure alcoholic. Having said that, I'll also say that what I heard right from the get-go from the old-timers was, do not take a drink or a mood-changing drug. And I am convinced, just as sure as I'm standing here, that if I ever did, whether I'm get into prescription drugs and abuse them or other drugs, now that's all I'm going to talk about drugs, that I'd be off to the races again. So I think that's important for us as alcoholics to know that, Dr. Bob was our first dual addict. He's heavy use into barbiturates and along with his drinking. So dual addiction is not new to the program. It's been around a long time. My childhood, I guess I have to start, actually before I start, I do have to tell this joke about this preacher. He was getting ready to preach a sermon, and he was talking to his wife, and he said, I think I can relate this sermon to skiing. She said, well, that sounds interesting. So he's working on this sermon. In the meantime, she's off doing whatever, she's doing other things. And he realized this wasn't working out, and he decided to change his sermon, and he decided to talk about sex. Now, his wife wasn't at church that Sunday. She was off doing something else. Some of the ladies saw her in the grocery store on Monday, and they said, your husband preached such a good sermon. He was so knowledgeable. And she said, knowledgeable? He only tried it twice and he fell off both times. So, luckily, AA doesn't have to be that way. So anyway, my childhood, some people have, childhoods are all different. My perception of my childhood when I was young was certainly a lot different than it is today. And I'll try and be very brief about it. My mother, I don't believe, knew what to do, either with my older brother or me, when we came out to shoot, because I don't really know much about my older brother. We kind of never were close. I was so into myself that I have nothing around me. It was of any importance to me. My family, my brothers, nothing. Things weren't important. Nothing was important. Needless to say, I hated my mother at that time. What came to light recently, let's back up a little bit. I did not get along in school right from the get-go. Whether it was first grade, second grade, third grade, fourth grade, fifth elementary school, I did not get along with anybody. I was always getting in fights. I was getting beat up because I wasn't a fighter. Everybody beat me up. I didn't know how to get along, didn't know how to do things. I remember my dad worked a lot, and so I would, you know, I'd actually stay out in the woods by our house, and my mother would be calling me for dinner, and I wouldn't come home. I'd stay out till 8:30, 9 o'clock, till he got home. And she wasn't a bad mother, you know. I was a bad kid, but she wasn't a bad mother. I was just one of these kids that was not going to do anything right. I was going to cause trouble, whatever I did. Now, the other thing that happened, and it wasn't until I was 25 years sober, I had this kind of dream in the back of my mind, or this kind of thought, that when I was very young, I was sexually assaulted. And it was so far back that I just kind of put it off to the side. When I was 25 years sober, a certain set of circumstances, a medical exam and whatever, brought to light that was true. And I was able to piece together probably when that happened. So I was a young kid, maybe 5 years old, 6 years old. So I'm screwed up out the chute. And then I had something else to put me in a shell that I stayed in for a lot of years. And I added alcohol to that shell very early in life. Probably as best I can remember, 7 or 8 years old. Now I can tell you, if you can go back to 7 or 8 years old and you can picture the coffee table in your small house, and if I was an artist, I could draw it out. That the liquor was kept in that cabinet in the low door. And I can remember the kind of liquor that was in there. Now that's, you know, I remember that. I don't remember much else about my growing up, but I remember that. Four roses or three feathers. My grandfather lived with us. Now, my family tree in this country is not very big. I can probably count them on two hands. But if you shake that family tree, alcoholics fall out. Both my grandfathers were probably alcoholic. My father was probably an alcoholic. My older brother, alcohol and drugs. My younger brother, jury's still out. Two girls were okay. There were five of us. So now you got that one down. I was number two. And, you know, I hear a lot of people when they talk about the feelings and the thought process that went into this drinking and all that stuff. I don't remember any of that. I do remember taking a big swig out of that bottle and feeling this warm glow. I don't remember the burning. I don't remember getting sick. I don't remember anything else except saying, wow, it's okay. It's okay. And that's a lot of my drinking is take that drink and go, ah, it's okay. When I pick up a drink, when I have those days. So that was my growing up. I was able to work through a lot of that. I used to think that I had moments of clarity. I realize now that God was really talking to me. By the way, if you don't believe in the power of prayer, you need to ask yourself how you got in that chair you're sitting in. Because I know I'm standing here only because somebody prayed for me. I'm sure of that. And a lot of people were praying for me back then. So several things happened in my early life. When I was 15, my older brother was arrested for breaking mailboxes. I flunked 5th and 6th grade. Go figure. You know, don't get along with anybody. And I remember thinking to myself, in 2 years, I'm 15, he's 17. He was given a choice, go into service or go to jail. And I knew that 2 years from that moment, I would be lucky if that's all they gave to me because I was going to be 10 times worse than him. I knew that. How I knew that? God was speaking to me, I believe, today. And what I did is I straightened up as much as I possibly could. And so I went from flunking out of school to a 3.2 grade point average in high school. I was able to accept, and my mother, like I say, she wasn't a bad mother, but I was able to accept, you know, she was a sick person too, and I could live with that. I was able to get into working on being a mechanic. I always took things apart and fixed things, so I did do some things. But I will back up on my mother. One of the things that as I look back, she tried to get me into Pee Wee League, she tried to get me into Cub Scouts, and Weeblo, she tried to get me into Boy Scouts, she tried to get me into music, she tried to get me into swimming, she tried to get me into all these things. I wasn't having any of it. It took me a lot of years to realize what she was trying to do for me, rather than my part did. So anyway, the next thing that happened, and I've got a copy of this movie on DVD. You have to be an old timer to know this movie called Days of Wine and Roses with Jack Lemmon. And it was done off a playwright, and it's very, very well done. And it showed a couple in California who just started off heavy drinking, got married, and went all the way down to Skid Row, living in flea bag apartments. Now, something, I ended up watching that movie at 17 years old, and not probably a normal movie I would have gone to, but I'm watching that movie. That was my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a speaker meeting that they displayed, and it was actors, Jack Lemmon, Krugman. And it was a very good movie, and I knew then that that was me. And remember, when I was 16, I already had a phony ID card. I'm drinking every weekend. I'm getting drunk. I was a blackout puking drunk. I lived 30 miles north of New York City. I'd drive into New York City sometimes, be drinking all night in there, drive 30 miles home, go 30 miles past where I live, come to in a blackout, wonder how I got there at 3 in the morning. And that was my normal weekend drinking. I'd be in bars. I'd drink either shots and beer chasers. If I did not have $20 in my pocket, we're talking about the 1960s, if I did not have $20 in my pocket, I would not start drinking. I just wouldn't drink that night. I did not have enough money. You know, I never, that I know of in my life, drank socially. I always drank to get drunk. And I remember a couple other instances. One, when I was real young, one was a party. More distant relatives, they worked in breweries, keg of beer there, and I must be 10 years old, and I'm standing around a beer keg, getting everybody their beers while I'm drinking one and getting one. And I was sick as a dog riding home from that party. And I vaguely remember being around the railroad tracks in town by the boxcars drinking with some people. Just vaguely, vague memory. And by the time I was 16, 17, I was drinking every weekend. But I straightened out enough to finish school and graduate high school. And it took me 14 years to complete that 12-year program. But that's okay, I completed it. Now, the only thing I knew about alcohol and alcoholism was that movie. But I knew me, and I knew that I had a chance to go to a 2-year community college. And I knew then that there was no way I could go to college the way I drank. So my story is binge drinking, controlled drinking, that kind of stuff. For 2 years, I controlled my drinking by not drinking during the week or very little. And then I'd get my homework done and had to study first. As a result, I had a good 3.5 grade point average, and I got drunk every weekend. I worked my way through college. But the other thing I have is I always say, we talk about fear. And not only do I have fear of failure, but I have fear of success. It took me a long time to deal with that one, realize that I have a fear of success. And I think a lot of alcoholics, it goes in our fears, the myriad of fears that we have. And so I go to 2 years of college. I got a 3.5 grade point average, and I flunk a required course because I just didn't want to write what the professor said, or whatever reason. And instinctively, it's this fear of success, you know. No reason I should have flunked that college. So I didn't get a degree from there. I waited for the Army to come around. I get drafted. I got married. Got to get married. You know, did I spend any time picking a mate? No. Just got to get married. You know, Vietnam's going on. I'm going to go to war. People got degrees in college. They got married. You know, I got to get married. Needless to say, we were two sick pups. So, got married. Now, I thought that being a man, I'm working 10-12 hours a day in a gas station waiting to get drafted. So when I come home, I should be able to stop at the bar, like my dad did, and have a couple drinks. The only problem was when I did that, I never knew what time I'd get home, if I get home. So that went on for about 4 months till the draft notice came around. I got drafted in the Army. Basic training, we were restricted. We weren't supposed to drink, but I went out to the beer hall. Now, they only serve 3.2 beer. I can tell you it takes a lot of cans of 3.2 beer to get a buzz on. And I'd go out to the beer hall and I'd get bottles of 3.2 beer, fill up all my coat and my pants. While I drank for, I had about an hour, I could get away with it, an hour and a half. Run back to the barracks, put them all down in the basement where it'd stay cold, run upstairs for bed check. After bed check, I'd go down and finish getting drunk. Now, the guy next to me in formation, little guy over here, he had a problem with alcohol. I didn't have a problem with alcohol, by the way. That was normal behavior. He had a problem. The reason I knew that is he took Sterno and strained it and drank the alcohol out of the can Sterno. I thought, man, that guy's got a real problem. I didn't think I had a problem, so, you know. Yeah, I just, a lot of 3.2 beer. Anyway, I finished basic training, advanced training. I signed up for OCS. Now, again, I'm going to officer school. I almost got thrown out of officer school, but I didn't. I successfully completed that. Again, 6 months, this time a very restricted environment, and I knew I couldn't drink. Now, I got two stories again, I don't remember well, but as far as I remember, I didn't drink for 6 months, but I met one of my classmates who said I did, so I probably did. But we didn't have much time. If I got out on a Sunday afternoon, that's the only time we had on base that I could have gotten anything to drink. So my wife, my first wife, had moved down there, and so anyway, I got through OCS, got commissioned officer, and I went to flight school. Now, my dream as a little kid, a little airport down the road, and I flew model airplanes. One of the things I got into as a young teenager was flying model airplanes, and neighbors helped build model airplanes and fly them. And, you know, there were some things that kind of kept me at least from going off that deep end. So I had this dream to fly, and now I have a chance to achieve that dream. But again, I knew I couldn't drink the way I drank. By the way, back to my first job as a lieutenant. I'm waiting 3 months, and this is important. This is, again, the fear of success. In the military, they have what they call a hail and farewell. They welcome in the new officers and say goodbye to the old guys, leaving, give you a plaque, and you know, and attaboy. And my boss, the colonel, called me in when he gave me my rating for 3 months' work. And he told me that as a new second lieutenant, he had never in his entire career seen one do as good a job as I had done. He had never seen a new lieutenant do as well as I did. And therefore, he gave me the highest rating he had ever given a new lieutenant under his command. So, there I am. I've done well. Now, a week later, I'm supposed to show up Saturday night at the Hail and Farewell and get my plaque. And I'm sitting in a flea bag apartment with one of the sergeants drinking beer and eating canned spaghetti and don't show up. That's my behavior. That's the kind of behavior I had. I went to flight school. So again, 9 months of rigorous training. I know I'm not going to make this the way I drink. So I control my drinking again. Wednesday night was a beer bash. I tried not to drink on Wednesday night. I drink Friday night and Saturday night. Well, I can tell you, by the time 9 months were up, I was drinking every night. I could not go 9 months, even with the goal of achieving my lifelong dream, I could not go 9 months without drinking every day. Luckily, for me, there was a war going on. They needed a lot of helicopter pilots. So, but I get to Vietnam, and I'm so full of fear, I can't do anything. I get relieved from my job. I can't fly. I'm drunk every day, and I can't do anything. So I got my bad OERs from my drinking, my bad efficiency reports. So alcohol affected my career. It affected my job. I go from there over to Germany, and I came in a position where I had 200 people under my command, half of them living in the barracks. Probably 60% of that company, 30% were abusing drugs, the other 30% abusing alcohol. Not all of them were hardcore drug addicts, not all of them were hardcore alcoholics, but they were abusing drugs. They lived in the barracks by themselves, were 18, 19-year-old kids. And now I'm in a position where I study drugs and alcohol because I have to counsel them. They all work. They're all under my command, and they live in the barracks. I think I did a fairly decent job over there. One sergeant came in, said, I got a drinking problem. I called Alcoholics Anonymous for him, you know. I didn't know he should call them, you know, but that's okay. You know, I was able to tell them where there's help. One of the things in studying drugs and alcohol, one of the things I read was, if you, by your own definition, or by the definition of your family and friends, think you have a problem with alcohol, then you probably do. Now, my wife, at that time, she definitely knew I had a problem with alcohol. My boss knew I had a problem with alcohol, and I knew I had a problem with alcohol. I was 3 out of 3. You know? Okay, better than that, batting average than that. Some of you know, I just came back from 3 weeks driving a Volkswagen camper I picked up out in Ogden, Utah, and I spent my anniversary and 3 weeks up in the Northwest camping out in an old Volkswagen camper. But it brings back memories, because I had one of those in Germany. And I came to in a blackout, driving the wrong way around a one-way circle at night in Paris, France, with my wife and baby in the back of the car, in a blackout. That's the kind of alcoholic I am. That's the kind of things I did. I think it's important to share that. I don't want a long drunk log. It's important to share that because you have to identify. Otherwise, I'm just up here, you know. Then we get to what happened. So my boss at the time, and I've got his name in here, and he talked to me. He was drinking a quart of scotch a day. I'm not taking his inventory. And he called me over to his house one night, and he got out the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's drinking. Got to chapter 5, and he showed it to me. And he said to me, Rich, if you keep going the way you're going, you're going to be right where I am. Now you know how we are. You know, in my head, yeah, right. If I ever get as bad as you, I'll have to do something about it, you know. You know, I'm delusional, you know. But I'm forever indebted to him. And he finally got sober. He lost both his feet in a car accident. He got what's called a field grade non-judicial punishment and relieved of command. Medically retired from the Army. But 3 years after I got sober, he got sober. So we never know what we say and do. But, you know, God had to be working in my life. You can't put this together. You can't, you know, I can't end up in that movie, watching that movie and seeing where I'm going and having this vision. I did not end up this real starting off the morning with my drink. I did morning drink, but not every day. I did daily drink, but something I'd go off and on. While I was learning about alcoholism over there, I spent the next 2 years with all the willpower that I had and could muster, all the knowledge that I could muster to stay stopped. I have to back up a little bit. When I was 11 years old, I left the church that I grew up in, and I told my parents, there is no God, I'm done. I'm done with church. When it talks about belligerent denial in the back of the book, that was me. There was no way anybody could discuss God with me or a power greater than myself because I wasn't hearing it. I would not hear it. A guy in Vietnam said to me, Rich, how can you look up in the stars in the sky and the universe out there and say there's nothing bigger than you? We're all sitting around drunk. Now, he's drinking too, you know, but he still gets it. You know, he's not an alcoholic. And my only answer was to pound the table and say, I don't know, but there isn't. What logic? You know? So, I don't believe in God. I don't believe in any power greater than myself. So, for the next 2 years, I am trying to stay stopped. I'm quitting and starting, quitting and starting, quitting and starting. With all sincerity, all honesty and sincerity that I could muster, all the willpower I could muster, all the knowledge I had, everything. I got laid off from the Army. And people say they don't lay off. They laid off 60,000 officers after Vietnam, 30,000 of them pilots. So I got my pink slip. I got divorced. Same month I got out. I went back to school and couldn't do that. That didn't work. Again, drinking and starting. Didn't work. Anyway, in all this life, I never knew how, we talk about relationship, I never knew how to have any kind of relationship, either friends, male friends, female friends. I never knew how to date a girl. I never knew how to do anything. I mean, I dated, but they always asked me. I just didn't know how to do it. I didn't know how to behave. Didn't know how to act. I was truly an emotional wreck. I was able to do somewhat okay in the world of work. That was about it, and that was somewhat okay. So now for the next 2 years, I've tried to quit drinking and stay stopped. And I had some things I said, you know, if I ever ride, I had a motorcycle I brought back from Germany. If I ever ride my motorcycle drunk, I'll quit drinking. I'm going down Route 50 in Annapolis. Truck drivers are blowing their horns at me because I'm weaving all over the road. I swear I'd never drive my motorcycle drunk. You name it. I always look at where it talks in the book about the things we do, like switching from beer to wine, changing what we drink, all these things. I did almost all of them, you know. I mean, I fit that description. Anyway, the next 2 years I try to quit drinking. I go back to school, and that didn't work. So I take a geographical cure. I go to a headhunter, and I get a job down here in Maryland. And I get down there, and as they say in AA, we take ourselves with us. You know, if nothing changes, nothing changes. So I didn't drink. I tried not to drink for 7 days. I was well motivated, by the way. I had to take a flight physical because I'm still flying in the National Guard, and I'm still a pilot, and I'm still in the Army, but I'm in the National Guard. And I go on the dock, you know, shaking, and, you know, like I would normally be, and I couldn't do it. I think I made 4 days, maybe 3 or 4 days. And after that, one of the guys, I went out to lunch with one of the guys at work, and I have a beer. He said, I thought you didn't drink. That was yesterday, you know. So I'm off to the races, so. Now I get to the Labor Day. There's a, I came down here in August, Maryland. Labor Day, there's a pool party at this apartment complex. So I'm out there playing touch football. I jump up in the air to catch a football, and when I come down, my knee is locked up 90 degrees, and it doesn't move. It's locked up. I was drunk. So when I say I've never been hospitalized for alcoholism, I have been hospitalized for drinking, and what it did to me. I've also never been to a rehab, but I paid my price. I paid my dues. Didn't have that many rehabs back then. So my knee locks up 90 degrees, and they've got to operate. And I'm in my little apartment, and it's full of booze. What happened to me was sitting around drinking. And now by this time, I said I didn't really do a lot of morning drinking, but at this stage, I started having lunch every day at 10 o'clock in the morning, so I could have a beer with it. So I was at that morning drinking point where it became a daily event. And I don't know exactly how long this was, but I call my sobriety date September 15th, if you really ask me, it's fuzzy. I don't know what day I called AA. I don't know what day I came into AA. I do remember the first meeting, though. So, I quit drinking again for the 100th, 200th time in this 2 years. I don't know how many times I honestly quit drinking. And I quit drinking in the afternoon, about 5 or 6 o'clock, early evening. Something clicked and said, this time is different. So I quit drinking. Now, I hadn't done anything yet. 24 hours rolls by. I'm still in my four walls, full of booze. Didn't pick up a drink. But now I got mild ETs. I got a headache. My stomach's all queasy. And I want a drink. I got on my knees instead. And I said a prayer to a God I didn't believe in, didn't understand, did not know. I said, God, if you could just get me through tonight, I know it'll be okay. And I felt this peace come through my body, the room I was in. I felt this peace that has never left me, that feeling. I got into bed, and I went into a deep sleep for 12 hours. God wasn't done with me yet. The next morning, I got up, and I looked up Alcoholics Anonymous in the phone book and made the call. The guy that came out became my first sponsor. I had my first big book with me. It's the second edition. We were looking at that earlier. It's well underlined, well used, and well read. Because I came into this program willing to do whatever it took. Now, I'm going to have to say, I only in one time did I have the thought, you know, we talk about the physical, mental, and spiritual. And the physical gets better first. Then we got to work on this mental crap. And then the solution is in the spiritual to maintain it. So we get better physically, and I'm no different than anybody else. I did have one time where I just said, maybe I'm not an alcoholic. Some people have a lot more than one. I was lucky. I only had that one time. I'm feeling good. I'm back on my feet. I'm off my crutches. I'm feeling good. My sponsor took me to a meeting. He didn't plan this. Again, it's the chair I was sitting in. God sent me to that chair. Because the guy got up there. The meeting my sponsor didn't normally go to, I didn't normally go to. But the speaker said he came in the program in the 1950s in Washington, D.C. And he's a little late parking his car and getting upstairs. They always had a greeter at the door. And the greeter said, he said, I'm sorry I'm late. I had trouble finding a parking spot. And the greeter said, oh, you have a car? Yes, I have a car. You still have your family? Yes, I still have my family. You have a job? Yeah, I have my own business. You don't belong here. That's what they did back in those days. 20 more years, he lost everything. And that's what I'm listening to. The only time he's going through, bye-bye, the baby out of that alcoholic. You know, what a message. What a message. It hit me right between the eyes. I have never doubted the fact that I'm an alcoholic. Have I thought about a drink? Yes. But I've never doubted that I'm an alcoholic. Have I gone through that third step and taken back my will? Many times. Have I taken back that decision? No. I haven't taken back that decision. But now, let's talk about the journey ahead, because this journey is fabulous. And people that hear me talk, I always talk about the journey. To me, it is the journey. It's not all the stuff in the past. It's the journey that I've been put on. And some of the things that have happened on this journey. I've got a second marriage. I've been married for 32 years to a wonderful woman who put up with me crazy as I am. Sick emotionally. A lot of my emotions didn't get fixed till the last 3 or 4 years. If you're not in a good big book study group, I highly recommend it. Because it's a continuing process. It is a continuing process. It's all about the growth for me. So, how did I meet my wife? I went to a Parents Without Partners wine and cheese party. It says in the book, we can go to these places. We can go to these places. We don't have to be afraid of alcohol. I had another alcoholic with me. I had a couple guys with us. You know, that we qualified. I had a son, and I was divorced. You know, she did ask me to dance, just like all the other ones. So anyway, I met a wonderful lady, and we're still married. We're still married to this day. I think we'll be married. I told her I'd marry her for one day. I truly did. I said, I'll marry you for one day. She'd been to some meetings with me, and she understood what I meant. So we're still married, one day at a time, because it is one day at a time. I went through the steps. I made a deal with God. So first and second steps were pretty easy. Yeah, I had to think about the unmanageability. Well, you heard my story. I just had to think about it. Because I now knew I was powerless, but I didn't want to be unmanageable. But it was. That didn't take much thought. I knew I was insane. I've always been insane. But, you know, insanity is not the insanity of being in institutions. It's the insanity of the things I did, picking up a drink and the behavior. That's insane behavior. Driving around in blackouts in Paris, France, going the wrong way around a one-way circle. That's insane behavior. So I didn't have too much trouble with that. When it came to the third step, and I can remember vividly when I took the third step, I did it sitting in my car by myself. I did it with my sponsor later, but and I had the little card with the 12 steps taped to my dashboard. And I made a deal with God. And I'm here to tell you, don't anybody tell you you can't make a deal with God. You can make a deal with God. God makes good deals. The only thing you have, I had to realize, and I realize now, and I did it, is it was on God's terms. It was not my terms. The deal wasn't my deal. It was a one-way deal. It's partially two-way. I gave up. What I said in my prayer to God was, God, this is before I met my wife, because I was 4 years sober before I got married. This is like 3 months sober. I said, God, you've got everything. You've got my job. You've got my career. You've got my love life. You have everything in my life. I will spend the next year, the old timers, some did it really quick, but they figured a year you should be able to go through these steps. I will spend the next year trying to fix Rich Dyke, Rich D, as best as I can, using these 12 steps. And I made that deal with God. I stuck to that deal. And it's worked out pretty well. In fact, it's worked out very well. I couldn't plan. You can't plan the job. The fourth and fifth step, there were a lot of things. You heard me talk about a shell. I blanked my whole childhood and growing up was a wall that I blanked out. When I was ready for my fourth step, the things that I needed to deal with at that time came back to me. It was like I was in a dream and awake. I went to bed, and by the next morning, it was all there. It was all there. I could put it all on paper. I put it all on paper. I shared it with my sponsor. One of the things he said is, and this took some thinking on my part, do you believe God has forgiven you? I said, yeah. He said, can you forgive yourself? I had to think about that one. I had to really think about that one. Could I forgive myself? Because we like to mull all this stuff over. I like to beat myself up. You know? But, yeah, I could forgive myself. I had to think about it a little bit. Made amends. Character defects. I didn't have any. But they have... Character defects have been a lifelong process in sobriety, and they're still there. I was off by myself for 2 days, and I pigged out on a half a gallon of ice cream and half a cheese. Got so sick, my stomach is still tore up. And my wife said to me, you do that when you're alone, and I'm not around. You're sneaking. What else are you sneaking? I'm not sneaking anything else. She's sharp. She's not even an Al-Anon either. So, you know, that's a character defect. I went to a spiritual retreat a few years ago where I really worked on character defects. So I did it pretty well, and I had a pretty solid foundation, but it came back again. And it really hit me, that willing to go to any length. So it's a lifelong process. I still have them. I've gotten rid of a lot of them, those that know my story in more depth. And I'll keep working on them. So I am willing to get rid of all these defects of character because they limit my spiritual growth. And they hurt other people. Not just me. It doesn't hurt just me. It always hurts other people. Making amends. My first wife did not, other than talking about our son, did not want to have any time to say two words to me. And rightfully so. But I sent her a letter, and that was that. Some 30 years later, I had a chance to actually sit down and have dinner with her. We were at somebody's funeral out in Texas, and be able to sit down and talk to her. And that's the first time I was able to sit down one-on-one and talk about any of it. So it comes in time. My parents would like to think I was never an alcoholic. I don't know that they didn't believe anybody could be an alcoholic, or I have no idea. It doesn't matter. They never accepted the fact that I was an alcoholic, and that's fine. But I was, you know, until they died, I was a good son. I visited them. I made my amends to them. Made some financial amends to the church I left, that I stole money out the collection plate. To my parents, my dad had a store, and I stole a lot of money from the store when he had it. And I was able to make that amends in a kind of a different way, but when they needed help living with the house, I was able to make that amends. Sometimes we don't have to... The amends, one of the big ones that came about is I always... It says we will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. For me... My service in Vietnam as a drunk always bothered me. I didn't know how I was going to close the door on that one or make that amend. I had a chance to go back in the military and serve out my career honorably and sober. That's an amend. That is an amend to my country and my fellow soldiers. If we don't stay with the journey in AA, things like this don't come to pass. Today I have a life second to none. And I'd like to highlight a few things that have happened that are really important in this life. My wife, when she was working over in Maryland, and I was in a job where I had some afternoons sometimes free, asked me to go to happy hour with her. People say, well, can't be around alcohol. That's not true. It doesn't say that in the book. It says we can be. She wants me there. I can be there. As a result of going there, one lady she worked with, I visited her son in the hospital when he was in detox. He now has 25 years sober because I was able to share my experience. Another lady she worked with has a brother. She did an intervention, and he's over 20 years sober. If I had not gone to those happy hours with her, those people never would have heard my story. We never know. I get on a plane, and I go to a sales conference in Hawaii, 4,000 miles away. It's a black tie affair, and table seats are all assigned. We're not sitting with our friends. And $300, $400 a night hotel, 300 or 400 people there. I've got maybe 5 or 6 years sober. Most of these are retired military guys in a sales organization. So when they're getting ready to toast, they're going to toast the president, toast the boss, toast everybody. And so they're coming around with the champagne or wine, and I take my wine glass, I turn it upside down, I put the water glass in front of me. The lady sitting next to me said to me, she said, "You don't drink?" I said, "No, I'm an AA. I've got about 6 years sober." She said, "Oh, I didn't know what I was going to do. I've got 3 buds, and I didn't know what I was going to do here. How did I get that chair? How did she get that chair?" You can't plan this stuff. This is the journey. You cannot plan the journey. You cannot plan the journey. It's amazing. I got to travel to Germany and go back there sober and take a small airplane over, fly it all around Europe. I got to AA meetings over there. My first sponsor passed away when I was about 2 years sober. He died at a fairly young age, 56. He had an aneurysm. He's a wonderful sponsor. My second sponsor came in 1944. He had one slip. I can't remember. I think it was 12 years. But other than that, he was continuous sobriety back in. And he died many years ago. While I was in Germany, I kept him as my sponsor by phone for 5 years. Not a good way to do it. Not a good way to do it. When I went down to Georgia, got out of Germany, came back to Georgia. I was down there several years, didn't get a new sponsor. I stayed active in the program, active in meetings, did not get a sponsor. I have a kidney disease, terminal kidney disease. I was born with it. There's cysts all over my kidneys. It's fairly common. And mine was a normal progression. By about age 60, you end up on dialysis. I had 13 people offer to donate me a kidney. If I was a drunk, who'd offer to donate me a kidney? 13 people. And a niece finally passed all the tests at UVA, and I got a kidney transplant. You know? That was a miracle. I have to tell you a little more about that story, because these, again, are the stories. I had nothing to do with my nieces and my nephew from my older brother's first marriage, because I didn't have much to do with him or his family. I had not seen these kids since they were about 7 or 8 years old. There were three of them. The boy is in an institution from drugs and alcohol. The older girl died from a heart condition. And so we heard about that. And my older brother's back in touch with him. So it's in Delaware. And I told my wife, I said, we have to go to the funeral. And something's bugging me. Got to go to the funeral. They say in AA, you suit up and show up. And that's what you do. So I said, okay, we're going to the funeral. We suit up and show up. So that's the first time I met my niece in, age 7 to age 40, in that long a time. So it was a great time. And I was able to show up sober and have to go into a lot of detail, but, you know, we're not all like that in my family anymore. There's at least one of us. The boys. The girls are okay. The boys are the best. That's okay. The next thing that happens is my older brother's second marriage. His son was ready to go in the Navy, and he attempted suicide and jumped out a second-story window and had some brain damage. He's pretty well recovered. He was able to go to school. He's getting married down in Tennessee. Again, suit up and show up. So I go to Tennessee. My niece is down there, same niece I just met. Now this time we're sitting at the table and I'm watching my diet. I can't eat potassiums, I can't eat tomatoes, I can't eat cabbage, I can't eat oranges. And I'm talking about my kidney thing. And she says, well, I'll donate you a kidney. And that's the one that worked out. She was lucky 13. Needless to say, she's my favorite niece now. And of course, she doesn't have a problem with alcohol. It's rampant in her family, but she doesn't have a problem. You can't plan this stuff. You have to show up. You just have to do it. My wife's... Here's a couple good ones now. When I was 17, I worked 2 summers in a union in New York. And I hated the union because, I wanted to work. I'm a hustler. And they're all, slow down, you're making us look bad. And they were all over me all the time. Man, my father and my godfather were two different people, you know. And I said, you know, this union stuff isn't for me. I don't like the union. So, you know, I really had just no use for unions. God has a sense of humor. He sent me 2 union shop stewards to sponsor. He has a sense of humor. And I didn't have anything against people of others. You know, AA doesn't care if you're black, white, Hispanic. They don't care what your sexual preference is. They don't care about any of that. None of that. If you're here legally, illegally, don't care about anything. Except if you're an alcoholic, maybe we can help you. That's all we care about. So God sent me 2 gay men to sponsor. I didn't have any problem with that either. You know? And some other people. So some of them are sober. Some of them are not. This is the journey. This is the journey. My wife's sister went underground. And it turns out, and I don't know that she was an alcoholic. She had a DUI. A lot of people have a DUI. She was not that I ever saw that much of a drinker. But she didn't deal with it. She was one of these so thin-skinned, she didn't deal with anything. And so she quit talking to everybody in the family. 10 years. We didn't know if she was dead or alive. Had no clue. One of my daughters, when I married my wife, I picked up 4 kids, plus I had custody of my sons, so we had 5 kids to take care of. So got right into that too. It's been through all the stuff. But anyway, one of the daughters said, I've been praying about Aunt Margie. And so that got me to thinking. So I started praying about Aunt Margie. Now, Atlanta, I lived in Atlanta at the time. The town of about 1 million people. Last we knew, Aunt Margie was in Oklahoma. I'm flying. I got my own airplane. I'm in a museum in Indianapolis. Got a World War II bomber, twin engine bomber. They call me up and say, "Rich, we blew an engine out here in Oklahoma City. Can you come out? We got one coming. Can you fly out here, pick up another guy, and help us put this engine on the plane?" "Sure, I can do that." So I live in Atlanta, over a million people. I fly up to Indianapolis in this museum I'm in, pick up another mechanic. I fly out to Oklahoma City and land to work on a bomber, a World War II bomber. We get there about 8 o'clock in the evening, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock. We go to a restaurant. We're not working that night. There's about 10 of us all sitting in the restaurant having dinner. About 10 o'clock, we've done dinner. Guy's up paying the bill, and I turn around, and there's Aunt Margie sitting there, waiting to be found. She was happy to see me. You see, we get in this withdrawal, and I don't want to speak out. I don't want to say something. She wanted to be found, you know. You can't plan that. You can't put those circumstances together. You cannot do it. So, you know, to me, the journey, the circumstances, you cannot put this stuff together. I'm about done, but I want to leave you. We don't see the Hazleton book anymore. We've become... Now AA has their own daily meditation. When I came in, we had the Hazleton 24-hour day book. And that was before all the political correctness, so, you know, we were able to sell them at AA meetings. In the front of that book is a Sanskrit proverb. Look to this day. And that proverb has been with me since day one. My 24-hour book is more worn than this. Way more worn than this. But that Sanskrit proverb has stuck with me because I do live this one day at a time. There is no way I can go 2 days, 3 days, 4 days without a drink of alcohol. I cannot do it of my own volition. And there is a drink out there with my name on it. I'm convinced of that. I was at meetings in St. Mary County. I was working down there for a couple of days at the airport. And a lady had just come back after 8.5 years sober and having a slip. And she just picked up a 1-year tip. And I said, you know, we all have slips. I spent 2 years with all earnestness of trying to stay stopped. How many slips did I have in those 2 years? I can't even count them. Those were slips. So we all have slips. I came in here willing to go to any length. And that's stuck with me. We have to be willing to do the tough stuff. And that's what trudge the road to happy destiny means. It means we just work through it and go on the journey. It means completing the journey. So the Sanskrit proverb, look to this day for his life, the very life of life. In its brief course lies all the realities and verities of existence, the bliss of growth, the splendor of action, the glory of power. For yesterday is but a dream, and tomorrow is only a vision. But each day, well lived, makes every yesterday a dream of happiness, and every tomorrow a vision of hope. Look well, therefore, to this day. And thank you for letting me share.